open an informational meeting on current insurance mandates. Joel, thank you for coming.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Joel Lario. I'm the insurance administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for taking me out of order here, allowing me to meet another commitment this morning. What I've passed out is a report that the department put together, published on November 6, 2002, on health insurance mandates. We originally started looking at mandates a couple years ago with the ambition of doing a full-scale study here in Oregon of exactly what the different mandates cost and how they impact on health insurance. And as we asked more questions, particularly of the insurers, we discovered that to do that project with any degree of rigor would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that the project had in fact been done in other states at those kind of price levels. And so rather than do our own study, we changed our focus to doing a survey of what had been done in other states so we wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel here. And what you have in front of you in this report is a compilation of some of the most significant studies that have been done elsewhere on mandates. And so I'll briefly review the results of that, of our study here, and then if there are questions, we can get more into the details of particular aspects of that. But I was asked by the committee chair to focus more specifically on the Oregon mandates and thoughts the vision has on that. So I'll be brief in my summary of this report and then move quickly to a more focus on the specific Oregon mandates. There are basically five studies that are summarized in the report. The first comes from the state of Virginia. They use one of the two major models that people have for looking at mandates, and that is that insurers are obligated in Virginia to provide cost and utilization data on mandates on an annual basis, and they've been required to do so since 1993. What their studies show, and the focus here in our report is on the 2000 Virginia study, which reflected 1998 Virginia data, was that the most expensive mandates by a substantial margin are the mental health and substance abuse mandate, number one, and then secondly, the maternity mandate. Those both are in the neighborhood of 5% addition to premium each. The rest of the mandates are probably another 5% or so, and in Virginia, the total cost of the mandates as a percentage of premium was 15.2% in that report. That's probably as close as you're going to get to a kind of average when you look at all of the different studies that are done, that you end up with probably 5% on mental health and substance abuse, 5% on maternity, and 5% for the rest of the mandates, give or take. The second study that's summarized in the report is from the state of Maryland. There, the Health Care Commission itself does an annual study, puts its own data together. They concluded that mandates, they had 36 mandates that they looked at. Oregon has 22 right now. Maryland had a 13.1% of premium. Was the conclusion they came to as the total cost. And then they looked at another variable, which is, I think, important in the mix here, which is if you're asking what the effect of mandate laws are, it's not precisely correct to say that the impact of a mandate law is to impose a new 13 or 15% cost on health insurance premiums, because you have to ask a second question, which is if we had no law, how much of this cost would be in the premium dollar anyway. So they tried to get at that concept through what they called a marginal cost analysis to determine what part of the premium dollar that went to mandates was there because of the law as opposed to because of voluntary choice in the marketplace. And the conclusion they came to was 3.4% would be the marginal cost of mandates. So in other words, about three-quarters of the total cost of mandates is cost that the parties would voluntarily choose in the marketplace, even in the absence of a mandate law. The third study we looked at was a Texas study, and I'm picking different pieces of these studies to just illustrate different aspects. In the Texas study, they asked insurers to estimate what percentage of premium dollar went to mandates, and the estimates for These are large insurers, not just the small companies, but the larger insurers range from 2% to 20%. That's something that gives you kind of the flavor of why we didn't get into our own mandate study when you asked for these. What we tended to get back from the carriers when we asked was, well, it all depends on what you mean, and do you mean this part of the market or that part of the market, or do you mean this part of the state or that part? I mean, it starts to get into a lot of specific kinds of questions, and when they ask the general question, it's a huge range, 2 to 20%. They did hire an actual firm down there for about $500,000 to do a study. They didn't do the whole market. They just did 13 key mandates, and they came up with a 7.8% charge for those 13 mandates. The other thing they tried to do in this material in the appendix here is to look at the benefit side of the mandate equation. When you talk about mandates individually, their cost-benefit side, you get it's speculative on both sides. You tend not to have real precise cost numbers, as we've seen from what I've already said today. And then when you get into the benefit side, it's even more speculative. So, for instance, there's a widespread notion that if you have a mental health mandate, insofar as mental illness connects to a lot of other problems in society, you save a lot of money by getting that treated up front. It's probably true in some broad sense, but exactly how you would measure that and prove it, we couldn't find any good data from anywhere that could sort of prove the social benefit. And then, of course, it's a little difficult from the insurer's perspective, because even if you could prove all of that, most of the cost savings or most of the benefits are external to the insurance system. There are things that fewer people in prison and other things like that that don't translate into savings for them. So you got that kind of problem, too, of what the economists call externalities. There's also a main study. The main study is kind of an outlier study in the sense that it found that mandates only cost 7.5% the premium dollar, but they use both. In some cases, they use a full assessment of the mandate. In some cases, they appear to have used a marginal cost of the mandate, the additional cost imposed by the mandate and what would have been spent otherwise. And then finally, there's an AOI study that's quite old, but since it's our own Oregon study, we put it in here, and it found that in 1991 that mandates were 8.1% of claims costs. That's a different kind of measure, but that they analyzed Regents, or at that time it was Blue Cross, claims, and decided that looking at the claims, 8.1% of claims costs were related to what were the mandates at that point. So those are the studies we looked at. So let me move now directly to the Oregon picture, and what we have. I'll refer you here to Appendix. I think it's B. In our materials, and what we've provided there, it's a two-page front and back summary, and this is something that we put together a couple years ago and then have been updating on a biannual basis as the legislature works its will on various mandates. You'll see there that we list 12, 9 on the front page and then 3 more on the back, so 12 what we call disease and condition or traditional benefit mandates that Oregon has, and you'll see we have the major ones there, chemical dependency, mental conditions, and maternity, which are the major mandates. And then we have a whole another series of mandates, benefit mandates listed there. A couple things I'll draw your attention to on the chart. One, there are a couple federal mandates. That's numbers 9 and 10 on the list. So the federal government does enter the picture here, as is oftentimes true in health insurance. There are things we can do and things we can't do in Oregon because of federal law. Most of the mandate issues we can take care of under Oregon law however we want to, but there are a couple federal mandates, numbers 9 and 10. And then you'll see, if you look at where the mandate applies to insurance type, none of the mandates, well, I guess there's a couple exceptions that apply to self-insurance, but basically most of these mandates don't apply to self-insurance. Self-insurance is what the large companies have, and it's probably about between a quarter and a third of our market is a self-insured marketplace, and they're not obligated on the mandates. And one of the things you'll hear consistently from the insurers on mandates is if you impose too many mandates on the insurance marketplace, then those businesses which are on the cusp of being able to go to self-insurance or have the option of self-insurance are going to be more likely to go to self-insurance to create more flexibility for themselves. So that's a part of the market. The mandates, by the way, also don't apply to about a third of the market on the other end, which is the third, and this is probably a third to 40% of the market that's either federally provided Medicare, Medicaid, or the uninsured. And as we know in this session, I put those together because there's an interplay. If our Medicaid population contracts, then those people are going to be on the uninsured side and so forth. But there's probably about 40% of the market that's either uninsured or insured directly through a federal government program, Medicare or Medicaid. So what you have in the middle here where these mandates apply is about a third of the market. That's the insured market. And that's an important fact to consider when you're talking about mandates. It is not something that you're doing to the whole marketplace. It is something you're doing to about a third of the marketplace.
Joel, why are 7 and 8 requirements in self-insurance?
Mr. Chairman, I was afraid you were going to ask me that, and I don't. When I looked at this chart, I don't know why those are...
I mean, that's counterintuitive that those would be when the others aren't.
Yes, the federal mandates make sense to me. I'm going to have to get back to you on that because I don't understand what authority Oregon has if those are not federal requirements that for us to be able to impose them on self-insurance. If either that's inaccurate or it's because there's some kind of federal authorizing legislation that would authorize it. But absent some federal authorization, the federal government can impose whatever they want on insured, self-insured, etc. We can't because of underlying federal law. So unless the federal government has done something to allow this, it's inaccurate. And I'll get back to you on that, okay, that point. The other thing I wanted to mention on the chart is on the back we divided out provider reimbursements as another kind of mandate. So you have mandates that say you must cover X disease, X condition, and then you have a second type of mandate which says not that you must cover a particular disease or condition, but that you must allow different types of providers to provide the service. You can't have just doctors require MDs to do things when there are optometrists who can do that's probably not a good example, but an ophthalmologist versus an optometrist. The legislature's passed laws saying you have to let the optometrist be able to do what they can do in terms of vision care in the marketplace. And that's that second list. I'll tell you in general terms, and we get in some trouble with some of the constituencies here, but in general terms, the provider mandates are harder for us to monitor and supervise, and they're also probably more of a burden on the insurance companies in the sense that, you know, they would rather be told you have to cover certain kinds of situations, but can they choose what kind of provider they want to have cover that situation? They tend to complain more about these, and it's also gets more difficult because you get into, you know, provider networks, and does the network have enough optometrists on the panels to really make it a fair access point and so forth? Those are the kinds of issues that come up. But yet there are real social values to allowing the different kinds of coverages, and in many cases they're actually cheaper too. So I'm not trying to say there are no competing arguments here. There are competing arguments on all of these things. Last point I'll make before I go to take some questions is sort of big picture. What can you do stepping back? Because I know the experience that we have, that you have, is the mandates come one by one, and there's a lot of rhetoric about mandates in general, but then you face the specific situation and you have folks up here talking about how that particular mandate will do this and that for them, and you see the immediacy of the need and that sort of thing. What kinds of mechanisms are there to try to put those specific situations in a larger context? And there the legislature has taken a couple actions in the past that I think, if they were pursued more aggressively, might very well have some promise. And that first of those is there's a statute, 171, or S171.880, which says that whenever a mandate is brought forward, there shall be a cost-benefit analysis provided by the sponsor. When we started into our report, we said, this is great. We'll go get all of that data, and we'll have a good starting point on how to analyze the costs and mandates in Oregon. Well, it turns out nobody keeps any of that data, and then we've since found out that, in fact, a lot of the sponsors don't even provide the data in the first place. So there's a concept in law that could be helpful to you. You could flesh that out. You could have, you know, some more kind of rigorous standards on how costs and benefits shall be measured, et cetera, et cetera. There's the starting point for that kind of making this more systematic. But right now it sits there as a statute that's kind of not the promise of it hasn't been fulfilled. Another statute that we took note of is 743-700, which is the mandate repealer. The legislature said back in, actually both these laws were from 1985, that any mandates enacted after 1985 would automatically sunset in 6 years unless specifically renewed by the legislature. And there are a couple mandates that have sunsetted under that law, minor ones, essentially, most mandates have been renewed under that law without a lot of back and forth debate. And now this term, as we've looked at the bills, the new tactic for people proposing mandates seems to be simply to write in an exemption from 700 into the bill so that there isn't even going to be the review. And again, I'm not expressing an opinion on whether it's good or bad to repeal a particular mandate, but if you want to look at some way of systematically reviewing them, there's a starting point for that, and if you put some teeth into that in terms of requiring that kind of rigorous review on a periodic basis, you know, it might be of some value as well. So that would be a second suggestion. The third thing you could do is have us do one of these $500,000 or $1 million studies to really get, you know, more precise and specific data on exactly how mandates affect the Oregon market. You can tell by the price tag and my inflection here that I don't think it's probably a likely option for you to choose. And we wouldn't do it ourselves, by the way. We would contract with some kind of actuarial firm that has expertise here. That could be done. I generally think there's probably less promise, particularly in the current budget situation, with that option. And then the final thing I draw your attention to is there is the bill this term to create a mandatory mandate moratorium. That seems to be the industry's preferred way to deal with mandates in this session. And that has some merit to it. So it's sort of like the repealer thing, except stronger. But I would also have to point out that it doesn't. I mean, ultimately, that's just another law, so each time someone brings a mandate forward, you would still have to choose whether you're going to stick with the moratorium that you passed, or it's like it'd be like a get out of jail free card. I've got this moratorium here that says you're not supposed to act on this bill, but it's still going to be a choice for you to decide whether to act on any given bill. But that's another option that's out there. With that, I'll stop and take any questions.
Questions?
Well, just comment, Mr. Chair. I mean, that third suggestion, we could change a few of Joel's words. We could put unfunded mandated study. make that a fourth option. Are you looking for a motion, Mr. Chair?
No, I'm not. Actually, at this point, and I appreciate this information, Joel. A couple questions. So the pre-85 stuff. Number one, I think most of that's probably covered in what's written anyway, but none of that. I was under the impression that some of the mandates in statute had sunsetted, but they were still there. But is that inaccurate?
Mr. Chairman, technically speaking, it is inaccurate in the sense that the mandates that have sunsetted are no longer in place. There are some that there was an argument about whether they did sunset or not, and there were changes in a couple of them such that started the clock running again. So there are some people in the building who think some mandates should have sunsetted that didn't, but there had been legal back and forth on that, and eventually the decision from the Attorney General's office and from Legislative Council was that where the mandate was changed, it started the clock again.
Okay. I mean, committee, the reason I wanted this information is quite simply the, you know, as we work on our problems with Medicaid and other parts of the healthcare system, it would be absolutely inappropriate for us to ignore the impacts that our current economic situations have had on the private sector. And we're losing folks at that end at a fairly rapid rate. And I think it's prudent for us to look at whatever we could do to keep folks in the private sector insured and keep that affordable. So, I mean, clearly mandates is an area that needs to be looked at. If a moratorium or whatever on some of these things would lower the premiums and keep folks insured, it's certainly worth a look at. So that's just my opinion, but a darn good one. So, and we're getting you out of here right on time.
Okay.
So thank you very much for the information.
Thank you.
We'll be in touch.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to close the informational meeting and open a work session on House Bill 2394. Sandy. 2349, excuse me. Must be Friday.
It must be. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2349, we heard on Wednesday, and the parties were instructed to go back and come up with an amendment, which we have in front of us. It's 2349-3. This was, or is, the bill that creates the Oregon Patient Safety Corporation as an independent public corporation to improve patient safety. We heard testimony on that. To the best of our knowledge, there are still a few concerns with the Dash 3, but the folks have agreed to continue talking about it. This does have a referral to Ways and Means. Just to point out to you briefly, page 6, lines 2 through 4, isn't it an effort of legislative counsel to address the Board of Medical Examiner's concern? Also on page 10, lines 26 through 28, is an addition that requires the corporation to acknowledge and be open to the public for Oregon statutory public meeting laws. And then the other area for the that attempts to address the Board of Medical Examiners is page 14, lines 28 through 29.
Question on page 10, lines 26 through 28. Usually, and I would, this won't violate the public hearings law. If they have a personnel issue, if in going over this systems problem that they may have in a person, and it comes out that a personnel was involved, usually that's held in executive session so that the names don't get out. I mean, is that going to be a problem?
No. If you go to the top of page 11, it gives the conditions under which they can be closed.
Thank you. That was my concern.
Okay.
Thank you.
I know there's still some concerns about this, and lawyers will argue about things forever, and I fully understand that. I think, in the opinion of the chair, this addresses all concerns. I think it's the Dash 3s cover everything, but I'm not a lawyer, so all I'm doing is reading it as if this was written in English and trying to understand it. So does anybody have any concerns? I want to hear from anybody. I fully understand the concerns some folks have, but we cannot, I don't think, in this process do completely away with paranoia. And And I say that as being one who's paranoid most of the time here. So, for very good reason.
Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
That's true. That's true. So I would entertain a motion on the Dash 3 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2349.
Representative Tomei moves the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2349. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2349 to Ways and Means with the Duke Pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2349 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a Duke Pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll. Excused.
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 2349, having received the constitutionally required majority, is declared passed. And we will open a public hearing on H.J.R. 48. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Joint Resolution 48 is urging the governor to allocate portions of money reserved under the Federal Workforce Investment Act of 1998 to provide training for health care providers. The 2001 Legislative Assembly enacted House Bill 3353, which created an interim task force on health care personnel. This resolution is a component that incorporates the recommendation urging the governor to address the shortage of health care workers in Oregon. You do have a portion of the final report and a hard copy of the health care sector employment initiative materials attached.
Okay. Joe? Oh, no, you can do it together. You guys have been working together behind my back on a lot of things, so just go ahead. That was a joke. Very likely. Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, so much for hearing House Joint Resolution 48. As you're very much aware, there is a critical health care personnel shortage in Oregon. We also have the highest unemployment rate in the nation, one of the highest unemployment rates. And here we have jobs in Oregon that aren't being filled, and there's a disconnect. So this is how House Joint Resolution 48 came about, because we need to support the effort that, or at least bring to make people aware that there is a health care personnel shortage. More health care providers in Oregon workforce means more jobs are being filled, and that means they pay high wages, and that means we'll have more money in more revenue coming in from the income tax. The five most critical shortage areas in our healthcare system are nurses, physicians and surgeons, radiological technicians, technologists, physical therapists, and physical therapy assistants and aides. And what this bill does, it provides a solution by urging the governor to spend the federal money that we get for educational programs and healthcare occupations and providing new program resources for critical shortage areas. I would like Joe to go on and speak a little bit more thoroughly on it, but besides helping the economy, this bill will improve the health care of Oregonians. The health care shortage directly affects the quality of all Oregonians' health care and their access to that care, and the shortage has created a significant strain on our health care system at a time when more and more Oregonians are requiring more health care services. The older we get and the more paranoid we get, the more health services that we'll need. And so we do need to go forth and hopefully use the Workforce Investment Act dollars toward at least solving our health care personnel shortage. Thank you.
So, Representative, what you're saying is that we need to create more jobs rather than raise taxes, and I can appreciate that.
That is the intent, yes.
Okay.
for the record, I'm Jill Bell with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I can tell you that we have the jobs. We just need the bodies to be educated to fill them.
Right.
And that's probably all I would need to say. I just wanted to let you know that hospitals and other healthcare employers have been very active in the last probably 4 or 5 years, participating in public-private partnerships to increase the access and availability of educational opportunities for workforce investment, and it's something that we're continuing to do. And we believe that funding healthcare workforce education is one way to address some of the economic woes that we have, plus it would certainly help the healthcare industry, as Representative Mona Sanderson has noted, to provide jobs that are sort of going begging, if we may say it that way. One of the things that we have done, and I have to apologize, I will get it for Sandy, is that we did a survey of hospitals to determine what shortages they had. We took the top 11 shortages, of which some of those are included in Representative Mona Sanderson's comments, and totaled up what the average salaries for each one would be and what the total impact would be. And for hospitals alone, it was $76 million a year. That's a fair amount of salary dollars that are waiting to be spent, if you will, to provide services to Oregonians. So we have been talking to the governor's office about using workforce investment dollars, and I'm here this morning also to tell you that Margaret Halleck, who is the policy advisor for Governor Kulongowski on workforce development, was unable to attend this morning, but she will be providing some written testimony for the record indicating that they are looking at addressing workforce issues by industry sector, and that one of the sectors that they are strongly considering is healthcare workforce. And part of the reason for that is that the Governor's Workforce Investment Board several years ago established what was called the Healthcare Sector Initiative, and they have produced the report that you have that Sandy mentioned, the Taking Aim report, and indicated that there was need for more dollars to be put into the system to help with workforce education. And then the final person that I'm here speaking on behalf of today as well is Barbara Amato, and she is our regional director for Providence Health Systems in their Human Resources Department, and she is one of the co-chairs of the Governor's Workforce Investment Board Healthcare Sector Initiative, and she also would like to be on record as supporting this proposal, and we would just very respectfully request that you pass the HDR 48. Thank you.
Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Joe, did you have a sense on those jobs that are essentially waiting to be filled of what the average salary might be for an individual, you know, over across that fair amount?
Well, a physical therapist's average salary is, a dental hygienist, for one, is around $60,000. A nurse is around $40,000 to $50,000, well, really depending on what kind of specialty they have. So they're high-paying jobs.
Yeah, you know, I saw this chart that Oregon AHEC put together. It's a great chart. It shows, you know, various allied health and nursing positions out there, and sort of what the salary range is, and then what the education is, or what the steps are to be able to be competitive for one of those jobs. And I have it in English and Spanish, and it's just it's a great thing, you know, if we can attract more people to those health fields.
Any other questions?
Well, just a question. Yeah, question, Chair. Are you going to allow equal time for the rest of the legislators on this panel to go to the witness stand and testify against the bill?
Well, Representative Westland, seeing how every member of this committee that's present except for one is a co-sponsor, I didn't think that would be necessary, including yourself. Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on HJR 48 and open a work session. Representative Dalto.
Mr. Chair, I move that we move House Joint Resolution 48 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dalto moves House Joint Resolution 48 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I think everything's been said. So, clerk, call the roll. Excused.
Aye.
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 Aye. And I think I do not want this on the consent calendar. I want Representative Mona Sanderson to carry. So House Joint Resolution 48, having received the constitutionally required majority, is declared passed. And I'll close the work session on HDR 48 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2995. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2995 is brought forward by the Oregon Association of Retired and Senior Volunteer Programs, the United Seniors of Oregon, the Portland Great Panthers, Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disability. It's appropriating monies to the Department of Human Services for the Retired and Senior Volunteer Programs, otherwise known as RSVP. It's declaring emergency effective July 1, 2003. It does have a referral to Ways and Means.
Jim and Beth. And keep in mind, we all like this, and we want to send it to Ways and Means, so you're not, you don't have to convince us. I'm speaking for the committee, but I don't think I'll get dissent on that one. So.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing the Oregon Association of RSVPs, United Seniors, Alzheimer's Association, Great Panthers, and the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities, who are the co-sponsors, the sponsoring groups of this measure. As you can see, this measure really is a vehicle for the reinstatement of the funding cut made to the RSVP programs. We are asking through this bill for $265,000 for the state-funded RSVP projects. That is. There's no increase in that. It is simply what was received in the last biennium. Since the inception of these projects in 1995, the legislature has given $1 million in state funds to very cost-effective, innovative programs put forth by the RSVP programs. We have 15 projects statewide. They provide social services to seniors and people with disabilities, academic tutoring and mentoring to young people, and community policing and crime prevention programs. On page 2 of the joint testimony that we have provided you, you can see that over that time period, we have had 6,300 volunteers that have been involved in these projects, reaching more than 67,000 children, seniors, and also, I might add that that doesn't count the 310,000 people that we reached by staffing the Justice Department consumer hotline. So we have provided in that time 339,000 hours of service at the rate put forth by the National Center for Charitable Statistics of volunteer time being worth $16.05 an hour. We have given back to the state in excess of $7 million for the $1 million investment that you have provided us. You can see here, before I hand it over to the RSVP president, you can see the breakdown of within each area what we have provided. Within the school systems, we've had 2,700 mentors and tutors providing over 200,000 volunteer hours and serving 29,000 students. We've had 1,750 RSVP volunteers working in social service capacities within DHS, particularly within the SPD arena. They have provided, they've reached more than 18,000 citizens with over 100,000 hours of volunteer work. And again, the Justice Department, we take put separately because we don't want to overinflate our statistics, but we've reached over 300,000 citizens through our work in the Justice Department. And then finally, under community safety, home checks, crime prevention programs, things such as that, we've had 1,800 volunteers providing 60,000 volunteer hours to more than 20,000 senior citizens around the state. Our feeling is, in closing, that with the massive cuts in schools, crime safety, and senior and disability services, that this is no time to cut senior volunteers who are helping fill the gaps in services. So we urge your support of House Bill 2995.
Thank you, Jim. Beth?
Hi, my name is Beth Fox, and I am the director of the Lynn Benton RSVP. So as we were talking about paranoia, I'm a little bit schizoid, if you know anything about Albany and Corvallis, two very different counties, one very rural, one a little more urban in nature. But I am a representative also as the president of the State Association of RSVP Directors. It is one of the most marvelous groups I've ever had the pleasure to work with, because the work we do is so meaningful, and working with senior volunteers is so amazing. Senior volunteers give more time per capita than any other age group, and they are loyal. When they say they're going to be there, they're there, and they're there early. In Lynn and Benton counties, our two state projects are health, senior mental health projects, and senior safety projects. And the senior safety project has a wide range of activities that we're involved in, from advocacy and education to actually hands-on installation of deadbolts and smoke detectors and safety devices that help people feel safe in their homes. We hear back from widows that say, you know, now that I have a deadbolt on my door, I feel so much safer. So we feel like we're really making a difference. There was a woman recently in the town of Lebanon that was seen by one of our senior peer consultants, and with the recent Iraqi war, all the memories of her son that died in Vietnam resurfaced. And she needed somebody safe to talk to. And she was referred to us for one of our peer consultants to visit with her. And it was a great match, because it was someone her age who could be neutral, who could be compassionate, and really help her get through a difficult period in her life. A very unfortunate statistic is the highest percentage of successful suicides occur in aging males over the age of 65. When older men intend to commit suicide, they accomplish the goal. We hope to end that by providing peers that they can talk to, someone they can relate to. Two of our projects in particular, in Deschutes County, Representative Westland, and also in Curry County, are at huge risk. Not only would their state programs that are sponsored by the state money be discontinued, but the programs themselves will be at jeopardy if they lose their state funding, because the state funding is match money for us for federal dollars. And it's very helpful, and especially in counties like Deschutes that has no federal dollars, or Curry that has a very, very stressed economic situation. This state money makes more difference than you can imagine. So I really implore that you would not eliminate the state funding in the next biennium. And I thank you for your years of giving it to us. I really believe it is the best rate of return you will ever see for the money you give. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth. Any questions?
Madam Chair. Over the years that I've been in the Legislative Assembly, I've looked at the work that's been accomplished with these funds, these meager, minimal funds, and I would challenge anyone to point to an expenditure that produces more good for more Oregonians than the funds that we've expended here. As was indicated, they're leveraged. They involve community members. They create senses of self-worth, purpose. This is just one of the best things we do, and I would argue that we receive more benefit for these expenditure funds than any other single line item in the budget. So I would obviously, as I know we all do, would encourage not only passage of this bill out of this committee, but to continue all of us to work with the Ways and Means process to make sure that this is funded. Thank you.
Representative Dalto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Davis, could you give us a status on the issue that we previously discussed about, I guess, monies being asked to be returned to the Department of Human Services from the RSVP program? Is that still in effect?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dalto, that still is an issue. Just to bring you up to date, our granting process is unique within state government because it's such a small amount of money that we're not allocated on a monthly basis. We're allocated an annual amount of money through SPD, which has been very supportive to us. We received an annual grant for this past, or this, well, now current fiscal year. of around $130,000, and when the cuts took place, we were on the cut list, and we received a cut, counting the reduction of our COLA money, of $53,800 approximately. And since we had already received the money, we were then asked to repay this money, which was quite unorthodox in nature, and we have asked that this not happen, of course. Essentially, it would shut down all our projects. To try to pay back this money would deplete our funds almost completely, and so we have asked that this not occur, and we've received some very strong support, and we're hoping now with the help of Senator Schrader and Senator Winters and, of course, Representative Belto, you've been very helpful as well, that in the April rebalance this has worked out.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2995. Open work session on House Bill 2995.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2995 to Committee of Ways and Means with a two-pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2995 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a two-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll. Excused.
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 2995, having received the constitutionally required majority, is declared passed. And I'll close the work session on 2995 and open a public hearing on 3066.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3066 is directing the State Commission on Children and Families to establish a program that improves child care providers. It establishes the CARES Child Care Professional Development Account. We have the dash two amendments that the panel will be speaking to. It makes some modifications. This has a referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Heidi and Phil, I don't see Representative Kafoury here.
I suspect he'll be down shortly.
Okay.
They were watching the video.
Is it inappropriate, Mr. Chair, to ask Donovan what video they were watching?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westland, as you know, you're beaming out on the World Wide Web, so I'm sure they're tapping into that.
That's why he wore this nice tie today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of Stand for Children, who are the sponsors of this legislation. What we were hoping to do was for Representative Kafoury to share some remarks about this legislation. And then to my right and to your left is Heidi McGowan, State Director for Stand for Children, who will kind of give an overview of the legislation. And then I would quickly bring up the rear here with a quick presentation of what the Dash 2 amendments are. I know you've had House Bill 3066 in your bill file now for a couple months. I'm sure you've gone over it a number of different times, so this is a good opportunity for you to familiarize yourselves. And now that I have successfully stalled long enough until Representative Kafoury is able to join us, I would turn to you.
Thank you. Good morning. Deborah Kafoury, State Representative, House District 43. We had a very similar bill to this last session, which passed out of this committee with strong support and unfortunately got caught up in the Ways and Means, Representative Westland, that wonderful office downstairs. And so this session we crafted it in a way that there is no fiscal and it's more of a policy statement about child care, and we think that this is definitely something that we all can get behind and support. Child care is a very important issue to all Oregonians, and hopefully I have these experts here to explain the technicalities of the bill, but I hope I can have your support today. Thanks.
Good morning, members of the committee, Mr. Chair, who no longer is here. My name is Heidi McGowan, and I'm the Oregon Director of Stanford Children, and thank you for the opportunity to present House Bill 3066. Stanford Children has initiated a research-based child care improvement program in Oregon that uses limited federal dollars effectively and efficiently. The root cause of poor quality child care is a poorly trained workforce, with an annual turnover rate more than 33% due to low wages. The CARES model provides incentives to retain qualified child care teachers and encourages entry-level teachers to pursue additional training through wage incentives and scholarships. The CARES model is considered a best practice and has broad support within Oregon's child care community. In 2002, the Oregon Commission on Children and Families granted funding for three CARES projects utilizing federal funds. Funding was also secured to monitor and evaluate the success of these programs. Our objective in the 2003 legislative session is to prepare the groundwork for statewide implementation of CARES as these projects prove their success. House Bill 3066 creates the policy framework to implement CARES statewide. We developed House Bill 3066 using legislative language similar to the successful creation of the Healthy Start program in 1993. House Bill 3066 establishes the key elements of a successful child care professional development program and creates accounting system for additional child care funds as they become available. We recognize the difficulty funding this model statewide during these challenging economic times. However, we can seize the opportunity to craft the appropriate policy framework for future funding opportunities. We urge your support of this important legislation. It makes an important step forward in our quest to improve child care and childhood education in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Heidi.
Vice Chair Tomei, members of the committee, again for the record, Phil Donovan. We have endeavored to bring together all of the stakeholders to create a collaborative process for input into this legislation, to craft it so that we can begin to dream about taking this idea statewide. So I wanted to quickly run through some of the amendments that you find in the Dash 2s. First off, there's one significant change is that in the original bill under Section 1, the child care division was named as a coordinating agency with the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. After working on the bill and talking with members of the Child Care Commission and with the Child Care Division itself, we realized that the entity that is responsible for drafting policy recommendations to the governor was more appropriately named as a coordinating agency with the Commission on Children and Families. So that is a change that you see in Section 1. Similar to the establishment of Healthy Start, the proposal amendment lays the groundwork for additional new monies. Now, under the original bill, under Section 3, it actually sequestered all of the child care monies. That was never our intent. We did not intend. And just for your information, the Child Care Development Fund receives about $4 million biannually from the federal government. Under the original bill, those $4 million could have been directed at CARES. And again, I want to emphasize that was not our intent at any time. And so we are pleased to bring forward this amendment because this would help put some people's fears to rest. Under Section 2, the changes are a little bit more subtle, but they are important because it ensures a collaborative process on the implementation of CARES, and it gives the Oregon Commission on Children and Families the flexibility to work with any interested parties with regards to some of the specifics, such as eligibility requirements, distribution of funds, education and training for scholarships. In other words, while we are trying to draft that broad policy framework, we are creating the flexibility for local commissions to be adaptable to local resources and local needs. Finally, in Section 3, this jettisoned the old language that sequestered all of the monies and just simply clarifies that the Commission on Children and Families has the resource or has the legal authority to expend resources for Oregon CARES. Now, in closing, we've constructed legislation here that works within the existing processes found down at the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, and as such should not have any fiscal impact. So we would respectfully request that the committee consider rescinding the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Under the original legislation, it would have made sense to go to Ways and Means. If you were to adopt the Dash 2 amendments, there is no fiscal impact. That's our belief. And as a panel, I think we're prepared for your questions.
Well, I have a little disagreement with that because Section 3 does state that money will be continuously appropriated to this, and so I think it's still a ways means decision because it's a decision on appropriating money from an account to a specific purpose.
Chair Cruz, the careful reading of Section 3 under line 20 is the statement established under Section 1 of this 2003 Act. So that's a reference back to Section 1. Mm-hmm. Coming back to Section 1, you would see under line 8 of the Dash 2 amendments that the sentence that begins, the State Commission on Children and Families shall support strategies based on the Oregon Cares model statewide through local commissions as additional child care funding becomes available. And so if there were monies to become available, suggesting most likely in the interim, if that were to occur, then that sort of budget limitation would have to be made, I think, by the interim Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd also like to put on the record that I did talk to Legislative Fiscal before the meeting started. They had just received the Dash 2s. They did express over the phone that even with the Dash 2s, they would have to, based on their brief analysis, would be issuing an indeterminate fiscal statement. If they have an opportunity or when they have an opportunity to talk to all of the parties involved to lay out better information for them, that may change. But at this point, as of 8:30, it would be of an indeterminate statement.
And I guess, Phil, that's my point. I mean, we've had very specific instructions from the co-chairs, and I would just like to have that before I rescind. I want it clarified, and I don't think that's inappropriate. So,
no, that's your prerogative, sir.
Chair Cruz, we would accept that absolutely.
Okay. Any other questions of this panel? Representative Mona Sanderson.
Is there anyone else that's going to be covered?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Bobby Weber, Mary Numers, and Jan East.
I don't know that Mary's made it here yet.
Oh, okay. Part? Mary may not be here.
Okay.
Is Bobby here?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
We're a little hot here, aren't we?
On the lights. Are we?
Yeah.
Are we back in?
Mics are just a bit hot. Okay. Please go ahead.
Oh. Chairman Cruz and members of the committee, I'm Bobby Weber. I'm the coordinator of the Oregon Child Care Research Partnership, part of the Family Policy Program at Oregon State University. And I'm here today in support of House Bill 3066. Over 60% of children are in non-parental care, children under the age of 13. Even children under the age of 5, that percentage would be pretty close. Because their parents are working or they're preparing to work in school or some other job readiness. And that makes it so that they need help in providing the day-to-day care of the children. The characteristic that has the single greatest effect on how well children do is the education and training level of the provider, of the caregiver. And there are numerous studies that have documented that as the education and training of the caregiver goes up, children's ability in terms of cognitive development and behavioral, especially the two things that we know are most tied to success in school, go up. And as they go down, we get more and more children at risk. low wages and the absence of benefits contribute to both a low education level for this workforce and to a high level of turnover. So the children get threatened and their development get threatened on both grounds. One of the most critical things that happens to young children is that they establish a relationship with the caregiver, that they know the caregiver and that the caregiver knows them. And there's almost nothing in anything we do that makes that kind of difference. So this turnover rate, which is around 40% that we're experiencing, the impact of that on children is devastating. And it's that dynamic that goes back and forth, a caregiver who knows what the child is in a relationship with the child and that the child is able to trust the adult. And it's that give and take that it's the heart of what makes us a human being and how well we are and how well. And the current way that the system is operating goes right to the heart of threatening that very core piece of what's happening to many, many, many of our young children. A coalition of business and public leaders in the state of North Carolina about 10, 12 years ago said that came up with a strategy that would hit the multiple components of this problem. And so their strategy, it goes under the name of Teach and Wages, the North Carolina model. And what it does is it gives people scholarships to improve their training and education level. Those are tied to agreements that they will stay in the job they're in for a period of time. And then they also receive in line with the level of education that they create for themselves, then they receive wage enhancements or bonuses. It comes in different ways. So what they did was they tied all three pieces together, and that program has been either adapted or actually replicated in many, many states. And seven of those projects have had major evaluations. And what the evaluation shows that the projects are working, that they have reduced the numbers, but they vary, but basically they've halved so that people participate in this program. The turnover rate has dropped from about 40% to less than 20%. Education levels have increased, and so that the children in North Carolina, they have been showing marked increase in what's happening to the children in child care. So Oregon Cares is built on what was learned in these other projects. And the design is based on the success. In Oregon, we have a federal grant that funds the Oregon Child Care Research Partnership that comes to the Child Care Division and then is a partnership that includes Oregon State. And we used monies from that project to design, well, we're in the process, for these new pilot projects of designing a performance measurement design so that we can build accountability into the projects as Oregon is developing, that we will be able, there will also be an actual outside evaluation, as was mentioned in the previous testimony, so that as by the time the funds become available to fund 3066, we'll have accountability system in place on a research-based model, and we will be able to have the programs actually meeting high standards for accountability. Again, we are happy to urge support of what is a very important piece of what we need to do for Oregon's children.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Jan East, and I'm a member of Stand for Children and also a director of the Little Beavers Preschool in Corvallis. Children in child care lose half of their teachers because they cannot afford to work in the field of early childhood. Because our educated providers cannot stay, 80% of child care is considered poor quality. During this last year, I have been subbing half of my time with children. Why? Because I am not able to find teachers with early childhood education. Can you imagine if our elementary schools had teachers with no training and they left their position every 4 months? In the past 30 years that I have directed, I have never seen parents struggle so much to pay their tuition or their child care fees, which is now double that of Oregon State's tuition. I have never seen the pool of educated teachers so small. It is nearly impossible to find people to hire. Excuse me. This severe shortage of educated teachers is affecting every child care center in our community, in our state. While we are in tough economic times, children need your leadership more than ever. Our children, during their most vulnerable time of development, need you to help them prepare for school. Thank you for standing for our children.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Kitty and Mickey. That's why I said it that way.
We request testimony in a cappella, Mr. Chair.
We could do that.
Please don't. Please don't.
Well, good morning. I'm Kitty Piercy, and it's nice to see all of you this morning. And I am here as chair of the Oregon Commission for Child Care. And I wanted to come on behalf of the Oregon Commission for Child Care to support House Bill 3066 and the proposed amendment. The commission, as many of you know, has a mandated responsibility to advise the governor and the legislature on the issues, problems, and solutions related to affordable, quality child care. We believe this piece of legislation is a carefully crafted piece and will enhance the professional development of child care providers in our state and therefore benefit the children to care for. I just wanted to remind you that last legislative session, the legislature passed a bill that required the Oregon Commission for Child Care to establish a task force to make recommendations for financing quality child care in our state. Our task force report identified that high-quality child care consists of children actively engaged in learning under the care and guidance of warm and nurturing caregivers who have the knowledge and skills to support their development. As you've heard today, research has consistently indicated that quality care by an educated adult is fundamental to school readiness. In other words, by investing in early childhood development, you will better ensure a greater return in your K-12 education investment. You know and have heard from several people today that child care workers receive minimal training due to chronically low wages. Many providers can't afford to stay in the profession. We must develop models like the one we're discussing today of private and public partnerships that support increased wages and training for child care providers. This is an important step in this direction. The Finance Task Force also recognized the importance of grassroots, locally driven advocacy for high-quality child care, where parents and community leaders join together to ensure our children receive the care they need. Stand for Children is a fine example of such grassroots advocacy. House Bill 3066 carefully balances a statewide policy with the resources and creativity of local communities. There are no scripted mandates within this legislation, and local commissions on children and families can effectively implement CARES as additional funding becomes available. In addition, I serve as the chair of Lane County Commission on Children and Families, and we have a CARES project. So we're here, I speak for both organizations at the same time before you today from both the local level and the state level. We urge you to pass this bill. Thanks.
Mickey?
My name is Mickey Lansing. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, the Commission on Children and Families is here today in support of House Bill 3066 and the -2 amendments.
Child care is a critical element in local systems as it relates to support for children and their families. In the last 2 years, every county in the state has been looking at what their gaps are as it relates to kids, what their needs are, where are the barriers, and what are the things that they can begin to do to start to support kids and their families in their local communities. As it relates to child care, two issues became very clear. Number one, professional development was essential for caregivers at the local level, and they also needed wage enhancements because of the turnover rate that you heard earlier from the previous testimony. Every single county in some way referred to these particular issues as it relates to child care. Recently, we received $2 million from the federal government, an additional $2 million in child care block grant money. And three of the counties that were funded have adopted the CARES model. We believe that local commissions on children and families have been looking for a model such as this that is research-based, that they can fund, and they can start to improve the quality of child care in their local communities. We want to thank Representative Kapori for her leadership today. We want to thank the Commission for Child Care, and we want to thank Stand for Children for all the work they have done on behalf of this issue. This has been really long in coming, and we fully support the implementation of this and other research models locally. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you. Thank you all very much. We're going to wait for folks at LFO because we're not going to get that today. So I'll close public hearing on 3066, and it will come back at another time. I'm going to open a public hearing on 3184. Sandy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3184 is modifying and making technical changes to the Child Care Division Contribution Tax Credit. It's permitting agencies that distribute the contribution monies to child care providers to be community-based. It's extending the sunset. It makes some other technical changes, and it has an application date of on or after January 1, 2004. This bill has a subsequent referral to revenue.
And Representative Kapori, Becky Shine, and Laura Smith, and Weather Coming Up Committee, I believe there are amendments still to come on this thing, but those amendments are more of a revenue committee nature, so it's my intention to refer this to revenue and let those amendments happen there. So, please.
Thank you. Deborah Kapori, State Representative, District 43. House Bill 3184 really is all about the amendments. It's about making some technical changes to House Bill 2676 that we passed last session. House Bill 2676 passed with overwhelming support. There were no dissenting votes in either the House or the Senate. And unfortunately, due to some technical difficulties, we haven't been able to implement it over the interim. So we have some amendments that we would like to add to the bill to change it and make it actually workable so we can get the benefit of the tax credits that we intended last session. I appreciate you having Child Care Day today. It's obviously a very important issue to all of us, and I think that since I'm one of the only members who actually uses child care, it's appropriate that I come before you today to talk about it. Thank you.
And you're going to be using it more in a number of months.
Okay. Chair Cruz and members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Shine. I'll be quite brief. I am a member of the State Advisory Committee to the Child Care Division on this tax credit program. As you know, these are simply technical changes. Just so you know, the goal of this program essentially is to increase private investment in child care to benefit the state's low and moderate income communities. So taxpayers contribute to the child care fund. They get a tax credit in return. The funds are then used to do three things: increase provider revenue, decrease parent cost, and improve the quality of care provided in those communities. As she mentioned, the State Advisory Committee and the Child Care Division came on a couple of obstacles due to the interpretation of the statute. It was recommended to us that we simply make some technical changes so it can be implemented as intended. Thank you for your consideration, and I hope you'll pass it on to the Revenue Committee.
Thank you. Laura. Nothing?
I think we're done.
I think we're done. Any questions?
Well, should, Mr. Chair.
Always him. Go ahead.
Yeah, since we're talking child care, I just wonder if it's appropriate to ask Representative Kafoury if she's come up with a name yet.
I think it's a little bit early for that. Thank you, though, for asking.
That's getting rather personal.
Well, you're talking about her, you know.
But that's a matter of public record, the fact that she is with child. So.
Well, the name will be a matter of public record as well.
Well, but obviously not at this committee at this point in time. Folks, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3184 and open a work session on House Bill 3184. Representative Tomei.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3184 to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
I would prefer without recommendation because we don't know what the amendments are.
Okay.
I don't think that's going to be a barrier here, but because we don't have the amendments.
Okay.
Okay.
I rescind that.
Okay. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 3184 without recommendation to the Committee on Revenue. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Excused.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Dalton.
Aye.
Representative
Montanus.
Aye.
Representative Westland.
Aye.
Representative Westland.
Can we let the record show that the without recommendation is noted because we don't have the recommendations.
Yeah, and I think
no opinion.
And that's true. And I think the unanimous vote also speaks something. But I've had a conversation with Representative Shetterly on this. He just needs the bill, so we're giving him the bill. Okay, but noted for the record. House Bill 3184 having received the constitutionally required majority is declared passed. For the committee members, be prepared. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Be prepared, like by next Wednesday or something, we may be scheduling some evening meetings. So I know we haven't been in the building at night yet, have we, Ben? Okay. Well, Oh. Representative, I was being facetious. Oh. Representative Westland and I have been in the building every night since session started, I think. Okay. I'm going to go into TAPS. Sandy said that Neil Bryant used to just do it as a block, but he was a lawyer and he could get away with it. I want to make sure that we don't have to go back for possible reconsideration of TAP bills, so I'm going to do it this way. So, open a public hearing on 2225, close public hearing on 2225, open a public hearing on 2324, close public hearing on 2324, open a public hearing on 2354, close public hearing on 2354, open a public hearing on 2453, close public hearing on 2453, open a public hearing on 2511, close public hearing on 2511, open a public hearing on 2500, close public hearing on 2500, open a public hearing on 2520, close public hearing on 2520, open the public hearing on 2522, close the public hearing on 2522, open the public hearing on 2561, close the public hearing on 2561, open the public hearing on 2609, close the public hearing on 2609, open the public hearing on 2613, close the public hearing on 2613, open the public hearing on 2692, close the public hearing on 2692, open the public hearing on 2742, close the public hearing on 2742, open the public hearing on 2842, close the public hearing on 2842, open the public hearing on 2884, close public hearing on 2884, open the public hearing on 2889, close public hearing on 2889, open the public hearing on 2940, close public hearing on 2940, open the public hearing on 2964, close public hearing on 2964, open the public hearing on 3011, close public hearing on 3011, open the public hearing on 3012, close public hearing on 3012, open the public hearing on 3024, close public hearing on 3024, open the public hearing on 3133, close public hearing on 3133, open the public hearing on 3153, close public hearing on 3153, open a public hearing on 3157, close public hearing on 3157, open a public hearing on 3293, close public hearing on 3293, open a public hearing on 3310, close public hearing on 3310, open a public hearing on 3364, close public hearing on 3364, open a public hearing on 3378, close public hearing on 3378, open a public hearing on 3393, close public hearing on 3393, open a public hearing on 3396, Close the public hearing on 3396. Open the public hearing on 3402. Close the public hearing on 3402. Open the public hearing on 3403. Close the public hearing on 3403. Open the public hearing on 3431. Close the public hearing on 3431. Open the public hearing on 3439. Close the public hearing on 3439. Open the public hearing on 3483. Close the public hearing on 3483. Open the public hearing on 3479. Close the public hearing on 3479. Open the public hearing on 3505. Close the public hearing on 3505. Open the public hearing on 3506. Close the public hearing on 3506. Open the public hearing on 3508. Close the public hearing on 3508. Open the public hearing on 3515. Close the public hearing on 3515. Open the public hearing on 3574. Close the public hearing on 3574. Open the public hearing on 3577. Close the public hearing on 3577. We are adjourned.
Thank you.